The first thing we're going to do is quickly talk about projects a little bit, and I apologize in advance for the fact that my voice is not 100% recovered from Sunday's activities yet. It was a disappointing Sunday, but, you know, my voice paid the price for it. Anyway, so here's kind of where we are on projects, and this is what sort of John and Josh and I have agreed upon, and what we think, as long as you guys say it's okay, you know, we'll go with. We're going to count projects as 20% of your grade. So each homework counts as 10%, 8 homeworks. Final 20% will be the project grade. That will be split. Half of the project grade will come from the oral presentation part, and half will come from the written part. Again, a sort of a short paper and a short presentation, few slides, 5-6 slides, that sort of thing. The key thing at this point is to start to send us project proposals. Now, some of you have been doing that already in email, and that's great, but just to sort of formalize things, send us an email with a subject line, PNP Cryptography Project Proposal. We would like to see proposals by class next week, and we will give, at least one of us will give you either a, yes, this is great, this sounds pretty good, here's some suggestions, or no, go work it through again and include it around with us sort of thing.
Email all three instructors.
Okay, at least one of us will respond.
Given that the entire project has to fit on, what do you say, 5 PowerPoint slides or something like that, how big a proposal are you looking for?
Paragraph. If you give us a 1 paragraph thing, okay, that's Josh.
I just want to be clear that we want everybody to be set on their proposals by next class, so. Don't wait to the last minute. Yeah. And if you have some vague ideas, you're not sure, you can email us with that too. The goal is a week from now, everybody has a buy-off from one of us on, yes, I am doing this as a project, it has been approved.
Okay. Okay, I got 2 questions here.
The written portion, you said before, should be not to exceed 5 pages, roughly 5 pages?
Roughly 5. I mean, I think last time there were some folks that did go as high as like 8, but, you know, please don't get into the mode where you're squeezing the margins, that sort of thing, you know, making it 8-point height, you know, that sort of thing. Legible, you know, it doesn't have to be huge, but, you know, convey. My rule of thumb is sort of 5 pages and about, you know, 5 PowerPoints. Right, because it's going to be about, what do we say, 10 minutes a person?
10 minutes.
2 minutes of PowerPoint's a good rate. Question over here.
Do you have like a definite deadline when we're turning in the paper version? Like, is that when we're doing our presentation?
We didn't talk about that, but we should get the paper before we do the presentation.
No.
You don't think so?
Well, do you think before? Josh, what did we do last time?
Last time, it was before. To go back a bit, as far as the oral presentations go, what we're planning on doing is having 4 nights of oral presentations, because there are too many of them. If you count 10 minutes per student, there are 60 students in the class. So we're going to split it up into 4 nights, 2 in Redmond, 2 in Seattle, and we'll sign up preference lists. We don't have to do that right now, but we'll try to make sure everybody's well accommodated. So if you figure that through, that's 15 people per night, 10 minutes, it's already 2.5 hours. You don't want any more than that. Each person will come for 1 2.5 hour session. Now, to avoid skewing things at the end, we're not going to say your written project is due at the time of your oral project, because then everybody will want to be last. So we're going to set 1 fixed date for the written projects. What we have to decide on, and we're willing to get your input on, whether that should be before all the oral presentations or after all the oral presentations. Anybody want to comment?
If we submit them before the presentations, are you guys going to ask us plan questions in advance?
There's only so much planning we can do with 60 presentations.
Yes.
You're overestimating our ability.
We will probably do it more on the fly, my guess is, because when would we have you turn them in? Would probably be the last class, which would be Tuesday. And then if we started presentations, say, Wednesday the following night and ran 4 nights, then, yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, we might, but, you know, if you happen to pick, like, you know, my thesis topic or something, then maybe I was going to go ask you questions, but I don't think it's going to happen.
So, can you say anything to reassure me, to bring me out of the depths of despair on my grade? Because I was just looking at the way you're doing the ranking, and if 80% is the homework, and each homework counts for 10% of our grade, then if we bombed one homework, that's a whole letter grade that, you know, we just drop.
No,
right?
Because it all gets curved at the end,
okay.
Right?
We all bomb.
Yeah, if we all bomb. I mean,
you're saved.
Well, I mean, give you all zeros on the next homework.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, at the end of the day, it's sort of a relative ranking. I mean,
okay,
that's,
okay.
It would be absolutely extraordinary if 90% were turned out to be an A and 80% of the possible points is a B, etc. That's not the way we will work.
Okay.
We'll take all the grades, we'll curve it, we'll scale it, we'll see, and somebody who does really well on everything except one homework should get a good grade. Exactly what that good grade is, we can't say at this point. But
okay.
You're not going to fail with everything but one.
Yeah, I mean, that's just not reasonable, right? We blow a problem and everybody kind of gets a zero on the problem, you know, just because of God. Other questions before we go into the homework? Josh, anything else?
I think we didn't actually tell him before or after yet.
Oh.
We didn't actually answer
I'm
that
sorry.
Question.
How about before? How about we say last class? That work, that way it's that, and all you got is the presentations afterwards.
And you don't have a homework that way.
You won't have a homework due then. Your last homework will be handed out lecture 8, due lecture 9. That means you've got the entire, what would have been homework 9 would be your final project work. But hopefully you'll start on it earlier than that. Okay?
And we should write up
The date off the top of that, that would be...
The
8th is a Wednesday, the 7th is a Tuesday is what I'm being told.
Yeah.
No,
our March schedule's off.
Yeah. No, actually, that's why it's built.
Oh, John's schedule's off by a day?
John's schedule is off by a day. Imagine that.
It was based on a
week. Okay. So,
we should post all these details on the website. We'll write something up and make it available. So you will have to take careful notes about this.
Okay. And we'll put this up. Any other questions? Okay, I'm not going to try and turbo through the homework so that we don't take up too much time. Question one was about time stamping, and I hope you kind of found this as an interesting little application of signing. Basic idea, client sends these hash values to the servers, the service signs them, creates a receipt. Question one was about what would you stick inside one of these receipts? And justify it. And there's a bunch of different answers. What I'm going to tell you is sort of what's the minimum set you had to kind of cover, and then what's an optional sort of set. The minimum set was you had to include the hash value the client sent you, otherwise why are we in business? You had to include the timestamp, which I've said here is, let me use yellow, is 15 bytes simply because I was using the character representation. If you want to do a packed representation of time, that's fine, but you could have just taken the value I gave you and said 15 characters, 15 bytes, and been done with it. And then what you probably need, actually what you had to have, was something that identifies the algorithm that was used by the service to sign. And this is because you don't want to let people kind of cut and paste, right? You could presumably have some sort of an attack where you sign with one algorithm and it turns out that could be used. The math works out on something else if you could figure out a way to translate between one and the other. So it's always a good idea that you have in at least some sort of a algorithm identifier, version identifier, something like that. Could be a byte, could be 4 bytes, could be a URL, could be whatever. That was the other idea. Quickly, yes.
That's a good idea, but if both client and server agree on the type of encryption or the type of caching you're using, do you have to include that information?
You would not if you defined it in the protocol. So if the way the protocol was defined was thou shalt only use this one, then that's true. You don't get agility out of that as a practical case.
I understand.
Okay? But yeah, if client and server said, look, we're only going to speak with this ALG, and this is how it's always interpreted, you could have lied that. Okay? As a practical matter, okay, when you are designing things.
You don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that. You want to identify, okay?
Okay.
Now, the timestamp server signature takes another 256 bytes because it's 2048 bits on the signature. That's the kind of a key. You did not have to include that because I sent a later mail that said I was talking about what was inside the receipt, not the signature itself. So you get points either way, whether you included it or didn't. stuff that was optional. You could have put more version numbers in. You could have said this is a version 3 timestamp and here's the ALGA identifier. None of if you included these sorts of things, as long as you justified them, they were good for the answer, and there's reasons to do all of these. You might have chosen to include the public key of the timestamp authority. You might have chosen to include some certificates for the timestamp authority, knowing that we're going to talk more about trust later on down the pipe. None of those were required. Okay? There's probably other things that you came up with at various points, and you know, if folks want to talk to me about that afterwards and why you include things, that's good as long as you had a reasonable justification. But the basic idea is you don't have to put too much in here. You're trying to get a signature over the hash value and the time, and maybe something, some other information. Now, question 1B is, how could you modify that operation? So assume that we've now got this stateless thing where clients send hashes into the server, the server signs and sends the signed receipts back, and how could you defend against a malicious insertion of a fraudulent timestamp after the fact? And I was looking at some of the problem sets people submitted, and folks came up with a bunch of different ideas. The one that I liked the best and what I was kind of looking for was this notion of hash chaining, where what you do is you take the hash of the previous timestamp you issued and you include it as a field inside the next timestamp you issue, and then every so often you publish whatever the hash was of the one you just did and you publish it in the New York Times. This is actually something that was this is formed the basis of a company that is still in business called Surety. Haber and Stornetta were the two guys who basically did the original paper on timestamping. This was back in 91, and they came up with the idea of a widely witnessed event, which is you publish a hash value and you chain things off of that, and then you get all fancy with hash trees and get all sorts of other data structures. But the whole idea here is you want to sort of link together the n minus first timestamp with the nth timestamp, and one way to do that is put a hash value in. Now, the downside of this is that when you get hauled into court to prove that this timestamp was valid, you have to go back to the last widely witnessed event and then show the chain from there forward. So you got to basically keep a week's worth, you know, or you have to keep all the hashes of what you issued and prove that stuff moves forward. But anything along those lines would have sort of been the ideal answer in this case. Okay? Any questions at this point? No, everyone kind of got it.
This is really the way it's done.
That's actually, this is it.
With the witnessed...
Yep, and there have been a number of referrals. If you go out to this, when the slides will go up on the website, and you go out to Surety and look, they got pointers to the original paper on this, and there's a bunch of variations of this sort of scheme. And they had patents issued on it. And this, Haber and Stornetta were at Bellcore, which was the spinoff from AT&T Bell Labs when they did this. They then spun off this startup company to go do it. And there have been other sorts of things along the way, but this is sort of the classic technique.
So for people that are inside the business, do they consider this superior or more secure than other schemes that say the hardware, a supposedly untamperable hardware setup that gives you the timestamp and
there's sort of sequence number? Depends on the scenario. So on the one, having the secure hardware, if you're inside an enterprise or something, is probably sort of fine. Okay. If you're talking about public timestamps out there and you care about getting hauled into court and standing up for something like that, then you really want to depend upon one of these widely witnessed events. The downside of this is that I believe it's still covered under patent, and so there's licensing issues on this sort of thing. And timestamps are actually still something that's being discussed widely in the business today, and they're still trying to standardize on it because various countries want to incorporate it into their own digital signature laws. And we can talk more about that at the break, okay? Question 2, mailing lists. Okay, I hope this was near and dear to everyone's heart, since we all have many too many mailing lists. Alright, so the first question was, we have this model where the sender sends the message in encrypted to the central server. The central server has to then redistribute it to a bunch of people. How much information does the sender have to know about the mailing list recipients? Nothing. The goal is nothing. That you can even have anonymous mailing list supported with encryption because you trust the central server to hold that information. Sender just has to know the public encryption key of the central server. What information does a recipient have to know about the mailing list server? Nothing to decrypt because the messages are just encrypted to the recipient. But if the server signs messages, then you got to know about the server's key. Okay. Or conversely, if the sender signs messages, then you got to know about the sender's key. Okay. This could all be done if it was encryption only with no signatures. You just have, you know, the decryption question.
So absolute security, I mean, if someone could maybe...
There is no such thing as absolute
security. I almost said that.
for security that depends upon cryptographic hardness.
For a high level of security.
Okay.
you would probably want the server to sign it because someone could insert a message and send it. If they knew the identities of some of the recipients on the list, they could insert a message and the person could think that it...
Maybe. It depends upon the context of the list. And it also depends upon whether you believe public encryption keys are public or private information. Okay? And that leads us to another discussion which we will take offline because I could rant on that for a while. Okay? But we won't do it here. Okay? Okay, but good point. If there are M members of a list, how many public keys does each member need to know and how many keys does the server need to know? The whole goal here was each member needs to know one. They need to know the public key of the server. The server needs to know everyone's public key so they can encrypt. Okay? Oh, and of course, you got to know your own keys. I mean, I kind of assume that you have self-awareness and you know your own keys.
Hopefully we didn't have to state that explicitly.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I kind of... I'm just putting it in here to be complete. When a sender encrypts a message that he wants to send, how many recipient infos will his SMI message have? This is how many destinations does it go to? Well, he's got one in this case, just in the server. If he wants to archive a copy for himself, does it make a difference? And the answer is yes, because he needs to somehow either save a unencrypted copy of the message... Or if he's going to save an encrypted copy, he better encrypt it back to himself so he can decrypt it later. Otherwise, he'll have something on disk that he can't read. Okay, so that was the point there, that just encrypting to the server doesn't mean you yourself can read your mail. And usually you like to read your mail later.
That depends on your protocol a little bit, though, because if you and the server are using a shared key, then you can read the server's email.
So long as you've archived the key back. Okay, and there are various schemes where you would want to do that. Now, there are some schemes where you actually don't want to have access to the message after the fact unless the server allows you to. But, you know, there's different sort of auditing mechanisms. What's one way the server could verify the message came from a subscriber? Could have the sender sign it, right, as long as he associated a signing key with every subscriber. So as long as you did the additional key management. So, you know, kind of to the differences between encryption and digital signatures here, and, you know, there's places where, you know, you get benefits out of each because they're kind of different, and you'd have to keep two keys, right? So as long as the server's willing to keep that database of keys, he could then say, well, you got to sign to submit. What else do you need to know? Does the server need to know in terms of additional information if he wants signers to, if he wants senders to sign? Okay, and the fact is, unless you're using the same key to both do signatures and encryption, which in general we said you don't do, and is sort of bad practice these days, you need to hold public signing keys for all of the senders on the mailing list as well.
So if you didn't make the distinction between signing and encryption keys,
it would be one, but you know, I think we kind of said that in general you don't. I mean, okay. You'd have to say what your assumption was in that case.
Right.
If a mailing list has M members, how many public key encryptions does the server have to perform to send? And the key here is he's got to do at least M minus one and maybe M, depending on whether the inbound message had a second save back to the sender. So if the sender encrypted it to himself, the server can save one operation if he recognizes this and not do it. If that wasn't the case, then he's got to basically encrypt to everybody. Okay, because there's got to be recipient info for everyone.
This gets back to you had us do a design and then you asked the questions, so there's going to be differences in the answer.
That's correct. So this is based on the design, and you could have differences. That's absolutely correct.
In the case of my design, I invoked a daily key, so the server doesn't do any public encryptions for a message.
Okay, that's a fair sort of thing, as long as the math works out on that. Okay, so that's an absolutely good point. So my answers here are based on sort of the design I presented. If you had a different design, it could lead you to different answers. And
when you say many recipient infos, you don't mean those are all on the same message, right? Because
yes.
It's just one recipient info per message, but you send it to a different copy of the
message. You can actually do it either way.
That's what I'm saying is you have a choice there.
Right? You have a choice, and there was a later question that asked if it mattered. And the fact is it doesn't matter in a practical sense.
I was going to ask about that. It does matter because if you include it in one message, then the recipients can count the membership of the list.
That's true.
There's some leakage. It's not huge, but there's...
Not only that, but if the message is big and fat, you don't want to have to That's such a big fat piece of information.
It does depend on some of your bandwidth. You're correct that you certainly could learn something about the public keys that were involved in seeing it. It also depends on sort of what the reply is. If I'm not sending to a mailing list, but I'm sending to five people, right, and I want them to be able to send it back, I'm probably going to form one message and then send it out. And again, you know...
It also reveals how many members there are on the list.
Yes, it does, and that may or may not be an issue depending on the structure of the mailing list. Okay, but that's a good point. It certainly does convey some information. The flip side is whether or not, depending on your mail server setup, whether it's better to have N messages or one message from a performance perspective.
Well, you also have one other issue, and that is that you've got a large, let's say you've got a folder in your inbox where you're keeping all of these messages,
mm-hmm.
and if you have a large list with many subscribers, each message could be three times bigger because of all those extra recipient infos, you know?
Yes, although if you're really concerned about that, you could purge them. There's nothing that says you can't drop that from a message. It's outside the signed portion.
Okay.
If you actually wanted to later, you could drop that information. But that's an engineering optimization from a size perspective. I mean, but it is true.
Well, for that matter, you could have something like the U.S. taxpayer mailing list, where one message goes to each taxpayer.
I'm not aware of any mailing list server that could handle a list that large.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? You know, even if you just took the taxpayer's file and goes all the taxpayers, I'm not aware of any server that does. But yeah, you get engineering trade-offs at that point, and you'll probably get your mailing list admin screaming at you however you do it.
The email from the IRS wasn't really from them.
And I got to tell you about that one from Nigeria that you got too. Okay? All right, so you know, in terms of number of public key encryption, it doesn't matter. There may be other engineering trade-offs. All right, how much symmetric key decryption and encryption? And again, this really depends on how you answer 2C. If you said in 2C, have the signer sign the message, then the server's got to do a content decryption in order to get at that signature to verify it, and he's going to have to redo the content encryption to send it back out again. If you had different protocols, you might have different uses, but that's because signatures are encapsulated underneath the encryption. You can't verify the signature to check that it's from a valid person without doing the decryption. Okay? So again, this depends upon what your design was.
For another reason you might want to decrypt it is, because if he doesn't decrypt it, he's got to then use this, pass along the symmetric key that the sender chose.
Right, which may or may not be an issue.
May not be a good idea.
May or may not be a good idea. He can't save some performance if he simply does it and resends it. That does also mean that the sender can force the server to do a bunch of public key encryptions with a content key that the sender chose. So yes, again, trade-offs on that side.
So if you essentially use the same symmetric key, the server then signs the whole thing again to send it out.
Well, he'd have to if the server's going to sign, which is sort of a separate step, then he's going to have to decrypt it. And at that point, he's going to sign it, and he's going to choose a new content encryption key. The only reason you would keep it would be if you weren't going to decrypt the content. You know, if you had some huge... You were sending a movie in mail or something, you know, and you didn't want to redo it. It's not going to happen in practice. Question?
What if you reverse the order of signing an encryption in your protocol for a specific purpose, that you wanted to be able to send out the signed unencrypted message to the rest of the mailing list members so that they could verify that it came from the person that was listed on the message?
I'd have to work through that. I'm not sure that works because
I just added this as a bonus.
As a bonus. Let me work through that at the break and see if I can break it for you. Okay. Because I might be able to. Sorry.
I was speaking with the anonymous part.
So the whole point on the anonymous, right? If you are having people sign in order to submit, you gotta strip that signature off. Because that signature identifies who it is. And so if you're going to create an anonymous mailing list, which is a common practice for a number of topics, you want to only have mailing list members submit, but you don't want to identify who they are. You may also want to rewrite it into being pseudonyms, where, you know, you have a pseudonym mailing list server, where the server knows the mapping between pseudonym and individual, but none of the other individuals know. And this kind of goes through that sort of way. And so you get that benefit. But if you want to strip off the signature underneath it, you're going to have to decrypt. Okay. All right, question three. I know I'm going fast. Describe a protocol that a new subscribing user and the server can use to send information to the server and authenticate that it came from the entity receiving. So the whole idea here was key registration. I wanted you to get a feel for, I'm a new user, I want to say I'm going to subscribe to the server. The server needs to get hold of my public encryption key. How do we do that dance? How do I prove to the, how do I give a key to the server and I don't have PKI because we haven't talked about it yet. So what level of assurance can I get and what's it look like? Okay, how do I know, and this is a big spam problem, right? How does the server know that I'm not signing up, you know, John to go get, you know, whatever the mail is? You know, because John likes, yeah, go right ahead, right. Well, you know, he's a symmetric guy and I'm signing him up for asymmetric crypto monthly or something, you know. So this is, again, there are various choices here. Let me walk you through mine, the one sort of I came up with. So I've got a subscribing client, C, and he has a public-private key pair which he's going to use for encryption, and he wants to give the public encryption key to the server. So he sends that in the clear, because that's the only thing he can do, along with his subscribing email address, or he fills it out on a web page or somehow. Now the server needs to be convinced that the client really receives mail at that address. So the server generates a random nonce and sends it back encrypted with that public key. Okay, so now the client, if that's really the client, at that email address, and we assume that email delivery works as it's supposed to, gets an encrypted message back. In the second phase, the client decrypts, gets that nonce, and then he could either send that nonce back, or what I like to do is I don't like to send nonces twice, I like to send the hash of the nonce back, so that the server can prove that I can prove that I got it, or I increment the nonce by one, or I perform some sort of mathematical operation on the nonce just to prove that I got it, I did something and I sent it back.
So what's the reasoning behind not sending the actual nonce back?
Just that why use this, I mean, from my point of view, it's sort of why use the same number twice if there's some sort of replay or some sort of mathematical relationship there. You could. It's okay to do it that way. I wrote it up this way just to get you to see a feel for some of the tricks we can pull. Once you know there's a number, if I send you a hash of it, you know, I kind of had to have the previous, or there's the reverse where I can commit to something by sending you the hash first, and then I send you the pre-image later to prove to you that I was the same person that sent you the commitment earlier. There's tricks like that. In this case, this could just as easily be N plus 1 or N. Those would all be acceptable. Okay, but I send back that hash value encrypted to the server's public key, server decrypts and verifies and says, oh, okay, this is the same person came to me earlier and gave me a key. That was the whole idea, right? It's a three-pass protocol. Client does a registration, server sends a challenge, client sends a response. That's basically it. Okay? Now, four was go to this group symmetric key problem, which says, all right, we can't do public key encryption on the server to send things out, so the server is going to distribute a random symmetric key to the clients. And again, depending on the design choices to how you chose to do this, you could have the server roll the key every message. You could have the server roll the key on a daily basis. The design I used here was the server rolls the key only when there's an event that happens where someone adds or leaves. That is, we're parsimonious with our public key encryptions. We're only going to roll keys and have to do a public key distribution of those symmetric keys when someone joins or when someone leaves. When someone joins, we just hand them the key that's currently active. When someone leaves, now there's a party that shouldn't get mail anymore, and we're gonna have to change keys. Okay, so how's that work? Server can hand the group symmetric key, or what I call the GSK, as part of registration. When a new user comes in, they get that GSK as part of it. And here's a modification to the solution I just gave in three on how to do that. All you do is you run the protocol as before, but you do one more pass of messages at the end. After you've exchanged, the server sends to the client, okay, I now know that your public key really is yours. Here's the current session key, and I send it back. And then if you want to get fancy, this was completely optional, but if you want to get fancy, you could actually get a confirmation message back from the client to the server saying, okay, I'm going to prove to you that I got that symmetric key, right, by either sending back the hash of that in the nonce, or I'm going to send the hash of it back encrypted to the server, or I could just send it back to the server again. There's all sorts of things if you want to do confirmation. But that confirmation can be important to make sure that the protocol actually completed. That was all there was to that step. Really, it was just this thing, just sending it back. All right. Now, how's that group symmetric key used? Well, it's used in sort of what you'd expect to be the normal fashion. When the sender sends a message into the server decrypts it, takes the content encryption key, re-encrypts it with the group symmetric key, creates one recipient info for everybody, and sends it out. And then everybody can go read it. Okay? Because everybody now looks for the same symmetric key in the key info. And that's why I talked about that KEK recipient info, both in the problem set and on the mail following. That's the mechanism for sending a key wrapped in another key. Key encryption key is what KEK stands for. And that was all there was to sort of that piece of it. Now, the interesting question is, what happens when somebody leaves? So if someone leaves by unsubscribing from the server then knows that the group key has to change because he can't send something out because the person who just dropped off the mailing list might be able to get that traffic anyway. And so he's got to roll keys. And so there's sort of two ways to do that. One way, right, the server generates a new group key, and he can send a separate control message to everybody and say, here's a new key, we're now rolling. And then the clients could then optionally say, okay, we got it. The other way to do it is to try to piggyback it on the next message going out to the mailing list, which is a little bit more efficient in the sense that you don't have separate control messages. Your client's got to recognize it. And what you do here is you'd make an SMI message just like you would normally. You basically make the SMI message where you form one recipient info using the group key to encrypt the content key. And then, and that gets included just like it always does. And then when the server tries to decrypt, or when the client tries to decrypt that, you can say, oh, I can't read this. I better go see if there's some other way for me to unlock it. And then you include here all of the public key recipient info, which give each user access to the GSK, which then lets them unlock. You can do it, there's a bunch of other ways to do it, but that's a way to piggyback it within the protocol. That's it, and I took less time than even last time, so I went through it. Questions quickly on this problem set?
Just the last question with this.
Yeah.
Would a one-time optimization, the sender uses the GSK to encrypt the message key?
Where the sender uses the GSK to encrypt the message key, you could do something like that and then have the server because of the concurrent unsubscribe.
So the server has a deterministic state, so they know if an unsubscribe is currently happening, and they can choose for the border case where that happens to resign the message again with the new GSK.
Yes, you're correct.
Is it's an engineering approach where you optimize for the common case, which is 90% there's no unsubscribe.
Yep.
And then in the 10% case where you have this sort of deterministic, you know, or it hasn't happened before.
What you're saying. Yeah, that would be fine too. And if that's the guy. So just to quickly explain, what he was pointing out was that, look, why are we doing public key encryptions even to send into the when the sender sends it to the central server? You have a shared symmetric key. Why not use that? The answer to that is there's a concurrency issue, which is that if the sender sends that in and someone's unsubscribed, they may now have access to that message if it gets sent out. So the one problem is that in the channel from the sender to the central server, if that channel is open, then a recipient who has then defected from the list could see it.
So
these are all engineering issues, and if you had a good discussion of them, then that's good.
Yeah, I just want to ask, because the model assumes the unsubscribe is voluntary. It's not that...
No, actually, part of it is the unsubscribe may not be voluntary, right? Okay. Someone gets fired, and all of a sudden you want to wipe out their access.
I meant the understanding I took from the problem. And hence, if it's voluntary, then you can just ignore doing it's unsubscribe and keep yourself on this indefinite.
That's true. Okay, any other questions?
Question here?
Okay, I got a question in Redmond.
It's probably provisioned by the ESMIME, but how does the recipient navigate to the its recipient info? How does it find
which? How does he find that out? Okay, that's something that I've kind of elided from it. There are a couple of different ways within the recipient infrastructure that identifying information could be included. One way is simply you try them. Okay, that's not very efficient, right, in sort of a minimal information. There are other possible mechanisms where some amount of additional information along with the encrypted key is injected into the recipient info. When we get to talk about certificates, one common way is you take some information out of the certificate, and you sort of index the recipient infos by it, or you tag them so that you have an encrypted key, and then you say, this is for the certificate with serial number X or serial number Y, or for this issuer name and serial number, or corresponds with the key that has this hash value. So there's additional things you can do. I elided that from the problem set because it sort of wasn't important to the sorts to this particular discussion. But you'll see some more of that in a couple of weeks. Okay?
Question?
Next question. There was another one in Redmond?
Yeah. For question 3 and 4, is it really wrong to assume that there's a central authority, some sort of a PKI infrastructure already established?
No, if you wanted to assume there was a PKI and explained it to that and where it would fit, I think that would be okay. It sort of defeats on the one hand some of the key management because you'd have, but I mean, I would let that go through because you'd then have to explain how the PKI key management works. And if you were going to do that before we covered it in class, I think I'll probably give you, if I were grading, I'm not grading, but if I were grading, I'd probably give you some points on that. Because I think you went the harder road, okay, if you did it that way. I mean, that you're correct that in a PKI environment, we sort of solved that, the key management problem described here in return for a different key management problem, okay? And after Lecture 8, you can be the judge as to whether that was a good trade-off or not, okay? And let me take this one, and then we'll go ahead.
Will this solution change if all these clients and the server are in the Kerberos realm instead of on the internet?
Good question. So if you were all in a Kerberos realm, you'd get two things. First off, you would have some keys with the server, and that KEK format for key encryption could also be, you could leverage your Kerberos key to do some encryptions that way and avoid the public key encryptions. The proof that you came, that you were authenticating the sender would also be possible if you used your, if you used a ticket with the server to do it. Okay? Let me think about what's going to happen on the recipient side because the problem is the server's basically got to go get tickets to send to each of the recipients. And if those tickets expire before the recipient reads the mail, there might be an issue there. It's possible that could work, okay? And we can talk about that offline if you want to talk about it further. Okay, I think there was one more question.
Quickly, I was wondering, you would assume have to add some information if you wanted to accommodate out-of-order messages, right? Because if you rekey and messages are coming out of order, someone might not know how to read something.
You would either want to keep the old GSKs, is probably what the clients would do for some amount of time.
Okay.
Right? If get to that effect, if you were just sending that way, you'd have to sort of archive those off for some amount of time.
It's not the old messages, though. It's the new ones that come in before you get the new key.
Well, and that depends upon which choice you used. If you did it by piggybacking, then you could get out of order on the new ones, and you might get stuck. I mean, when my mail server was down, I was getting messages from you all at completely out of order times. You know, it gets confusing when the threads come in backwards. You're correct on that. If there were control messages, you'd at least know that, okay, I haven't received it yet, I can't open this, and I'm in a pending queue, right? And if you're engineering a protocol, you have to have some way to say, I never got the control message because mail is not a reliable protocol. Resend, okay? That was above and beyond the scope of the problem set, okay? And I'll leave it at that.
I thought that was the crux of the problem myself.
Okay. It is from an engineering perspective, perhaps. All right, anything else? Great, thank you. I'm going to turn it over to John now, and he'll take you through. What are we doing? Linear and differential tonight, right?
Yeah.